the board of Dallas Law Service Forum. And I want to thank everybody for coming out. We meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, except for the end of December. And I want to know, do we have first-time visitors? We have several first-time visitors. Okay, welcome. So how did y'all hear about us? How did you hear about us, sir?
Through Meetup.
Meetup, okay. Anybody else through Meetup? Okay, several of y'all. All right, I agree. And that gentleman back there, your philosophy professor from Richland, recommended that you come here. So she's a female? Yeah, so she passed that on. So who else is new? Okay, and how'd y'all find out about us?
Meetup through Google.
Meetup and Google, okay, great. Well, welcome. It's great to see a lot of young people out here and maybe some budding philosophers along with the rest of us. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Carla, she is our treasurer. She's filling in for our treasurer, so it's $5. So if you haven't paid, then please do so right after our meeting, after Dr. Howell's presentation. It's $5, and then if you're a student with ID, then it's only $2. So it's a great bargain to hear some riveting philosophy discussions and presentations. Then also, if you want to subscribe, the cost is $35 for 6 months, so there's a savings there. So if you want to pay for six months of speeches, presentations in the future, it's only $35. And then also, I want to remind you to pay for your meal and your drinks as you leave, if you haven't already. Every once in a while, someone inadvertently forgets to pay, and then we're stuck with the bill. So please remember to take care of your bill. I also want to mention that we have a website, www.philosophersforum.org, and so there's some FAQ areas are there, some questions that you can go in and learn more about our group and find out about speeches coming up. We've got our schedule out there, and so you can see what other activities and other events we have coming up in the near future. And then if you enjoy what you experience tonight, then please pass the word on to your friends and your family, and we'd love to have a full house. And then lastly, please turn off your cell phones or put them on a vibrate mode so that no one's disrupted. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Tonight's presenter is Dr. Robert Howell. He's an associate professor of philosophy at SMU, and he just got tenure today.
Right.
No, that's wrong. You got tenure a while back. Now you're a full professor, right? So, yeah, you got tenure a few years ago when you were promoted to associate professor. So now he's a full professor, so we're in for an extra special treat tonight. He earned his PhD in philosophy at Brown University, and decided not to follow his family in the business world, decided that his real passion was philosophy, so we're benefiting from that tonight. In general, his work concerns the nature of subjectivity, the self, and the mind. His current research deals with a view called subjective physicalism, which maintains that while everything is physical, some physical states cannot be fully grasped unless they are occupied, and he can maybe go into some detail on that thought later on tonight. Dr. Howell has spoken at several Dallas Law Service Forum events in the past, most recently in our debate a couple of summers ago on free will in human action. He will be speaking tonight on the mind-body problem in the 21st century, and please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Howell.
Is your thing on? This thing should be green.
Hello, hello.
Is the light on?
Hello, hello.
Oh, it pushed over.
Hello,
you're
hello.
You're good. Here. You should be good now. Go ahead.
Hello.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I am really, excited about being here because I think it's a fantastic thing that the Dallas Philosopher Forum exists. I was published on Facebook, which is basically, where I shout, my trivial things to the world, and I mentioned I was coming here, and everybody kind of responded saying, that's fantastic that Dallas has something like this. Why don't we have this in Lincoln, Nebraska? Why don't we have this in, Boston, Massachusetts? And the fact is, it is something that I think more people will want to emulate, and I'm really glad that, you guys are keeping it going. So,
34 years old or so.
34 years old. Wow, that's fantastic.
Okay, I've been in it
33. 33. Has anybody been in it 34? All right.
They have to be older than Bob.
So, I guess we'll just have to take your word for it that it was not actually here. So, so now that we're in I guess 12 years into this century, I suddenly find myself speaking about the mind-body problem in the 21st century, and I hate to tell you, but it's not that different than the mind-body problem in the 20th century. Philosophy is that way. But I do think that there's a sense, you know, when you say the mind-body problem in the 21st century, that you kind of feel, some of you will probably feel like, isn't that kind of like, you know, the 20th century and witches, or something like that? Like, aren't we done with the mind-body problem?
Yeah.
You know, weren't souls done away with? Well, I mean, I don't know exactly when, but a long time ago? Surely we have enough, you know, science now to where we no longer have to talk to pitiful philosophers to learn anything about the mind. And I think that there's some truth to that, actually. I think that we've made incredible headway on the mind-body problem. And some of the problems that we used to think were problems, we don't think are problems anymore. But I think a reasonable constituency of people who find themselves still puzzled by the mind-body problem, and a particular part of it at that. And the part that I'm puzzled about is the problem of consciousness in particular. And that sounds very sort of mushy and pushy, and I'm going to try to make it a little bit more concrete in a couple seconds. But I'm going to lay my cards on the table to begin with and tell you that I am a physicalist. So I'm somebody who's very puzzled by how my own view can be true. I think that everything is made out of basic physical stuff, and that at the end of the day, once you get all the physical stuff, you get the brain, you got everything you need to basically have consciousness, beliefs, desires, everything that you want. So that's, you know, sort of my starting point. I think there's really important reasons to believe that, because I think the main reason is that any other view makes it very difficult to explain how exactly the mind can do what we know minds do, right? We know minds actually have a lot to do with our raises of our arms, our speakings, of our processing information and churning out more information. And this would be pretty mysterious, I think, if this were done by something ghostly that shared nothing in common with the neurons and stuff that are firing up here. This is a very old thing that was actually noted in response to Descartes' work. So this is nothing new, that basically, if you believe that minds are souls or something like that, you're going to have a hard time sort of explaining how it is that souls, which are not spatial, they're not anywhere, right? That they, you're going to have a hard time explaining how they interact with things that look like they work entirely based upon sort of spatial and spatio-temporal relations, which is pretty much what we're learning from the sciences. So I think there's really good reason to be a physicalist. But I do think that we shouldn't be so cocky about our physicalism that we ignore certain explanatory problems that I think still exist. And so the one that I want to talk about in particular, I think the best way to raise is in terms of something that some of you may be familiar with. It's called the knowledge argument. A philosopher named Frank Jackson from Australia came up with this brilliant thought experiment that I think a few people sort of dismissed immediately out of hand, and then it generated this tsunami of literature that is still going to this day. And I guess it was 1982 or something like that. Is that right, Justin? Something like that, when Jackson published this, and nobody stopped talking about it since. I just recently finished a book on it, and I have to say I'm not happy. I'm thrilled that the book's done, that it's accepted, but I got to tell you, I'm not happy with the result. I don't really understand a good solution to this problem. And so here's the puzzle, and I can tell you where I stand on it, and then hopefully we can kind of talk and you can kind of give me your feelings about it and whether or not you think it's a real problem or not. So here's the way he kind of puts the problem of consciousness. He says, let's imagine a brilliant neuroscientist named Mary. And actually, this woman is not just a bright neuroscientist. I think that we want to have her be brilliant across the scientific board, so that basically all the things that we consider physical sciences, biology, neuroscience, and basic physics, whatever you want, she knows everything about. right? And so she's not somebody who can exist right now because we haven't finished any of this stuff. There's a whole lot more work to be done on all these fields. Well, let's just give her all the sort of, you know, information that these scientists can impart with this limitation. Mary is going to be locked in all of her life in a room that's black and white. And she has only texts that are transmitted to her through black and white screens, let's say, or I don't know, maybe we can allow a little bit of color, but like in general, black and white screens that convey to her, you know, the images and the words that convey the truths of physics and the truths of neuroscience and the truths of biology. And she's not only perfectly well-informed, much more well-informed than any of us will ever be, about these sorts of physical happenings, but she's also a perfect reasoner in that she doesn't make the sort of stupid mistakes that I make every time I read any sort of physics text or neuroscience text or anything like that. She can follow it perfectly, and not only can she follow it perfectly, but she can actually see, oh yeah, so it happens like when basically you have this, you know, shortcoming with respect to neurotransmitters that you're going to get this sort of depression, and I see why that's the case because the neurotransmitter, you know, you get very far in that idle folly. Mary's got it. And the question that Jackson asks is, he says, give her all this. There's a lot of things she's going to be able to do. She's going to be able to tell you, based upon the knowledge of people's brains alone, whether or not they're, you know, they have a belief in God, whether or not they have a belief in, you know, Scientology, whether or not they desire to drink milk or beer. She's going to be able to tell you an enormous amount just based upon looking at people's neurons. Well, even if you're already skeptical about that, let's just grant him that, right? There's a reason why I think that he thinks that that's the sort of thing that she can understand, and we can talk about that in a bit. But what he does think, though, is that there's something that she's not going to know. There's something that she will only gain when she actually leaves that room. So at one point, I guess that realizing that they were really terrible to this person to make her learn all this stuff in a room, they let her out and present her with a rose. And she sees red for the first time, smells the rose for the first time. The question is, when she sees red for the first time, does she learn anything? Is there something that goes off in her mind and says, ah, when all these other people were actually walking around seeing roses, looking at the napkins on the tables, they were having these sorts of experiences. Now, I knew, she says, exactly how these things reflected light. I knew precisely how the eyes absorbed that information and processed it down to the visual cortex and how that actually sort of had repercussions throughout, you know, the cognitive system. I know all that, right? But she said, until I saw this, I didn't know what it was like to see red. I mean, there's something it feels like, right? And one can imagine that she goes and she tastes the brisket enchiladas and she's like, this is better than red. This, you know, I didn't know anything about this. I knew all about tongues. I knew all about the physics of tongues and all about the physics of brisket, which is an emerging science. But I didn't know anything about this taste. Wow. I mean, like, the world from my room was impoverished. And my picture of the world was impoverished. So I've learned something, says Jackson. Jackson thinks that that's what we should conclude. And I think a lot of people feel that intuitively. And I count myself as somebody who does. The problem is this. As a physicalist, I just gave her all the physical information that she needed. I gave her everything that we get from the physical sciences. Everything that is that can be conveyed through text, through things that can be conveyed through a black and white screen. And one might be reasonable in assuming that that's all that we need to convey when we're actually conveying information about physics and things like this, because, you know, why would science require us to have particular experiences, right? Objective science requires that the information that it conveys be, you know, conveyed to people who aren't actually having particular experiences. You don't have to be an electron to know things about electrons, right? You don't have to actually have a pancreatic disorder in order to know everything about a pancreatic disorder, except how it feels. But suddenly, here's this thing, where it appears that not only do you not have the right sort of information, you know, to kind of come to understand it when you're in the room, but like, it looks like you're lacking the the most important feature of the seeing red, of the tasting of the brisket, of the feeling of the pancreatic cancer, all of this actually can only come through experience. So he says, you've given her all the physical information. So she knew all that. She learned something new when she left the room. Therefore, physical information is not all the information. And it's a very simple argument that looks good to me. Like, she knew all of this domain, all the physical information. But if there's something more to learn, that means that that didn't cover it. Left something out. What did it leave out? Well, according to him, it leaves out the what it's like, the consciousness. Right? And there's features of consciousness that she certainly knew, right? She knew that basically when people saw red roses, they said, oh my goodness, thank you so much, you know, I'll give you something next Valentine's Day when I remember. She knows that, you know, when they smell red roses, they say, oh, it smells a whole lot like this and not a lot like this. But she doesn't know what it smells like. Right? So even though she knows a lot of facts about consciousness, actually, it looks like there's a crucial kernel that she doesn't know, which is sort of light that comes on when we actually taste our tastes, feel our feels, and smell our smells. So what Jackson suggests is that that's it for physicalism. I mean, if it's the case that all the physical information can't provide that information, then all the physical information is not all the information simplicity. Something's lacking. I find that actually to be a fairly hard pill to swallow, because, I mean, what the hell else is there, right? But on the other hand, I find it a very hard thing to deny. The idea that she could come to know what it was like simply by virtue of knowing exactly how the information is propagated along neural channels or through visual channels or off the rose through the air, the idea that that is actually going to get her the taste of the brisket strikes me as implausible. So, we have this case, which is anti-physicalist. And there are various different ways arguments have gone to actually try to amplify this. But the basic idea is not, at least Jackson's idea, is not that there's a soul. He doesn't want to bring back old Descartes. He doesn't want to bring back anything spooky occupying our bodies. So I don't think that we should sort of throw him in the dustbin of history and these sort of old ideas. I think he wants to say, all that I'm saying is that there are features of the mind, by which I mean features of the brain, I think he'd be willing to say, that you cannot get by physical descriptions of the brain. The physical descriptions of the brain are going to leave something out. Does that mean that there's a spirit or ghost or anything like that? No. It just means that basically there are properties, there are features of the world that are not physical. There are features of the world that once you fix all the spins and charges and all the, you know, momentums, all the energies that don't appear to be fixed. If you know all that stuff, it can still be open to you that seeing a rose is like what it's like to see a lemon. For all you know, that's the case. Well, so that's the first step. And I find that very puzzling. Because the problem is that it doesn't look like this is a sort of explanatory shortcoming that's going to be sort of resolved by a new finding. It seems to be a challenge to the explanatory framework. It seems to be a challenge to the sort of thing that we find when we study neurology, when we study physics. It's not like I'm suddenly going to figure out, oh, turns out there's a nerve I didn't realize, and that's what it... No, that's not going to do it, right? Because that story is going to be the same sort of story. It's going to have to do with the propagation of information and physical means, but I'm not going to be able to sort of understand that information by virtue of understanding how that works. So, there's a word. Well, fairly famously, it was responded to early on by a guy named Paul Churchland, which some of you are probably familiar with. And Churchland doesn't have any truck with not only this consciousness business, but with minds at all. He's somebody who actually is known to believe that there's no such thing as beliefs, that all that is just sloppy talk. We should be talking about neurons, or we should just shut up. Well, I'm not going to follow him that far, but I do think actually he has something interesting to say about the knowledge argument. What he says is this. He says, well, the problem with this argument is that let's apply it to something mental. Right? So what you've done, Jackson, is you've basically given Mary, you've just stipulated, which may be a problem here because we don't understand what the hell you're stipulating, given that we're kind of in the dark about a lot of this stuff, but we'll let you stipulate it. And you're stipulating that she knows everything about physics. Well, let's suppose that there's some other thing, a soul. Let's suppose that there's some ectoplasm. Whatever it is that you want to basically supplement physics with in order to explain this mysterious consciousness you talk so much about. Well, okay, let's make Mary an ectoplasmologist in addition to our neuroscientist. Let's lock her in the room and give her the full ectoplasmic facts. Whatever the hell those are going to be. But we're only going to give it to her through black and white screens. She's going to walk out, and she's going to have the same experience. She's going to see red, she's going to be like, holy shit, all this neuroscience plus ectoplasm didn't help either, right? I'm sitting here learning something new. So, what Churchill thinks is that shows that basically this argument works a little too well. Because it seems to work against whatever it is that the anti-materialist is going to want to posit or believe in instead of the brain to try to explain, you know, what this subjective experience is like. Well, I think that challenge should be taken seriously. I think that there are some problems with it. But it is a challenge that should be taken seriously. And here's basically my way of thinking about it. My way of thinking about it is this, is that what Churchill has pointed out is that the problem with the scientific explanation, the problem that's being pointed out by the knowledge argument, isn't with physicalism, per se. Because the same thing works against a certain form of dualism, or a certain form of view which actually posits something in addition to physical processes. The problem is with the way in which information is being conveyed. I don't think this is what Churchill would say, this is what I would say. Is that it shows that actually, no matter what you pick for your stuff, if basically the way in which you're describing the stuff is purely objective, that is, that it prescinds or abstracts from any particular subjectivity, any particular way of experiencing, and just describes it in objective manners, which presumably is intersubjective, which is presumably the sort of stuff that we can actually convey through these black and white screens, that you're going to leave something out, in some sense. The way I take Churchill is to say that's actually not to actually argue against physicalism. It's arguing against objective physicalism. The view that basically the full truth about physics and physical stuff, including neurology and biology, stuff like this, can be conveyed objectively. It can be grasped objectively using this way that we, you know, do it using good science. But objective dualism would similarly be troubling. That's what sort of response argument is trying to show. You know, if you have an objective science of ectoplasm, that's not going to help you either. Well, when you start to view it this way, as not a matter of the physical versus non-physical, but as a matter of the subjective versus the objective, and where that is a matter of not the stuff that's out there, but the way you describe it, the way that you actually characterize it, then I think that opens up a space that hasn't really been clearly occupied in philosophy, which I call subjective physicalism. And according to subjective physicalism, the view is, yeah, the physical story is the whole story, in the sense that basically, once you get all the physical stuff, you got all you need. Right? But that doesn't necessarily give you all the information in another sense. There's a sense in which basically some of that stuff can only be fully appreciated in all of its detail and all of its contours by virtue of being a certain thing. In this case, being a brain, right, that has certain sorts of brain states and that interacts with an environment in a particular way. Which is to say that dualism loses in a certain way, but it wins in another, I think. In other words, the scientific picture of the world is absolutely correct in that it tells us what you do to make a world. If you want to make a world, make it out of this stuff and you're done. You don't need to go and add souls, you don't need to add, you know, multicolored sprinkles of qualia on people's heads or anything like that, right? He's made the world. But don't expect it to be the case that anybody who studies that process, you know, or the constituents of that process in an objective manner is going to fully grasp all the contours of the world, because some of those features of the world can only be grasped by the occupants of it and by subjective minds who actually are doing the tasting, are doing the smelling, are doing the seeing. Does this make the non-physical? No. But it does make it the case that there's a limitation on objective ways of depicting the universe. There's a limit to objectivity. That limit isn't metaphysical in the sense that basically, you know, well, like I say, it doesn't leave anything out. But it's what a philosopher might call an epistemological limit. It's a limit on our ability to grasp things. And so, for my money, the mind-body problem of the 21st century is just this. It's actually coming to grasp the idea that there might be physical things that can be, you know, specified that are, you know, that, I mean, like us. You know, you've completely described me in a way, if you've kind of described my neurons and all that stuff. But that there's still sort of a gap of understanding when you look at it from the outside. That basically, some physical things you can only fully understand from the inside. You can understand them physically from the outside, but you can only understand them fully from the inside. And I see the mind-body problem as having this as the most crucial challenge. And it's the sort of challenge that I don't think is going to be resolved by, you know, Christoph Koch or others who actually study and say, well, you know, it turns out whenever you have a conscious experience, there's this going on in your brain. I mean, I can understand that as somebody who has that conscious experience. I can understand that by saying, okay, yeah, I grasp what it's like to taste, you know, the burrito, and I see it, you know, it looks like that in my brain when I do that, there must be a connection there. But for somebody who had never tasted the burrito and was only looking at the image, would not be able to grasp that. This is, I think, a somewhat unbridgeable gap. And I think that, you know, maybe I'll be surprised. You know, maybe there'll be some sort of a breakthrough, but this doesn't strike me as the sort of thing that's going to actually be resolved by further sort of scientific pushing. It may be that this is actually the sort of boundaries, one of the sort of transcendental boundaries of our ability to understand things. And that we have to accept that in a certain amount of modesty, and that one of the implications of accepting that with modesty means that we don't go off the rails and say that there's something like a soul, or say that there's something non-brain-like, but the modesty requires that we also be a little conservative about, you know, how much we say that we really understand when we see those flashing images of brains, when we talk about the chemical releases through neurons, and when we talk about what's exactly going on in the visual cortex. So I guess what I'm encouraging is a combination of confidence in the physicalistic picture, but also modesty in how we view it, insofar as I think that there's going to be some explanatory shortcomings that we're not going to get over, and that we're going to wind up grappling with, and it may actually provide, you know, that the very grappling of it may actually provide a very important part of what it is to be a human, trying to understand ourselves in a primarily physical world. So, that's basically it.
Yes, you're...
Hold close your mouth.
You're thinking this thing from the viewpoint of a super being of Mary, who was well-versed in all knowledge and things. Now,
physical knowledge.
Yeah, I would suggest that you take this from the opposite end, that is, someone who maybe doesn't know any language or doesn't know anything about this, they would feel the same thing on seeing color and seeing these things as she would, but they wouldn't have the physical description of it. Now, that, and maybe my first prayer comes to the mind of the Aboriginal and some of its culture, some of its things. They seem to start with the feeling and rather than the objective scientific denunciation, they start with the feelings. And so to that extent. Now, I don't mean to swear on or anything like that, but that's so. That would my comment. That's just my comments on this. But
if that was a question, would you repeat it, please? We couldn't hear a word about here.
Well, yeah. Can you maybe put that in the question?
You just have a question.
Hold close to your mouth.
Okay.
Close to your mouth.
The question
speak
is.
Speak louder, please.
The question is, how about a person who couldn't speak at all, who had no language, who had a chance to learn no language, but had a high IQ, and they would be only with feeling. They would only subject with feeling. And they would not have the advantage of having a high IQ and having put everything into words. We're talking about somebody that's somebody that puts everything into words. There's a certain conversion of putting everything into words first before you do that. So that might be another thing. That's the question. How does that compare?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether I think Mary puts it all into words first. I'm kind of skeptical about that picture of thinking. I tend to not know how the words are until I start saying them, which is maybe a reason not to invite me again. But I think that what you've got really is you've got kind of Mary's opposite insofar as you've got somebody who has a really damn good subjective picture of the world, but actually is lacking the objective picture of the world. And I think that's a shortcoming as well. I mean, you know, I think that quite possibly it's a much greater shortcoming. I'm probably biased. I'm from a Western society full of science, but I think that, you know, she'd be lacking, the person who lacked the scientific concepts would be lacking something. I'm attracted to the idea that basically, also that the way things feel can be affected by having certain concepts. So that I think that probably the way the world appears subjectively to somebody who lacked a scientific framework could very well be quite different than the way the world appears to me, who has somewhat pitiful but Western scientific framework.
Also, a related thing, when a person is blind,
they
seem to see, when a person is blind, they seem to see more detail in other areas of their senses. And this may be a key way to get into that.
Interestingly enough, actually, Frank Jackson in this paper has an oft-neglected part, where he talks about a guy named Fred. Poor Fred's been left behind. But where Fred actually is able to see, like he can look at these napkins and they're all red, but actually he's able to sort them into two different types of red. He can just see, apparently, a difference between, you know, red that we can't see. And so the type of example that you're giving of somebody who is deprived of a sense and thereby has an amplified other sense is very much in keeping with that. And I think you'd say, without that amplification, we're lacking an important sort of information as well.
I enjoyed your talk very much. I think artificial constructs like that are interesting, but not useful. Plato with his, cave and that sort of thing, good for discussion, but not useful.
Why are they good for discussion?
Anyway.
Good for discussion.
Okay. I'm a doctor. I come from the physical scientific point of view. I believe you can't have a mind without a brain. But the mind is not something that's separate from the body. It's a function of the brain.
Yeah.
It's just like digestion is a function of the stomach. For physicalists, to reduce the brain to neurons and chemistry and physics, we might as well take the brain and put it in a wearing blender and say, okay, there's nothing different for me as a physicalist, in that wearing blender than in the mm-hmm. functioning brain.
Mm-hmm.
I think we don't have to discuss it, and I want to ask you this as a question. We don't have to really have this dichotomy thing if we kind of look at it as the mind, the functioning of the brain is a threshold, an emergence of complexity beyond chemistry and physics that you can't explain in terms of just physical attributes. any more than you can explain life in terms of chemistry or physics either. So I'd like your take on, you know, the function, the mind, and the consciousness as an emergent property beyond which, you know, it's a threshold that's gone beyond just chemistry and physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a handful of questions there, and they're all good. So one of the things that you say that I'm not sure I completely agree with.
Whoever it is.
That's what it's like to hear a cell phone. So one of the things that you said I don't think I completely agree with, although I'm in no position to defend what I'm about to say, which is that chemistry and physics don't explain life. I think that's probably not right. I think that probably a chemist would say that there's a crucial difference actually between our understanding of consciousness and our understanding of life. And here's part of the reason, and I think you're quite right to actually point to function here. And I think that if I made the impression that basically the argument depended upon, you know, just telling her, okay, there's these neurons firing and there's these sorts of juices and like, let's just talk about the juices and, you know, now what have you got? Yeah, she should be completely clueless because a whole lot is in the functioning. Just like if I told you basically that there's all these wires, you wouldn't necessarily know there's a radio. Right. So you know there's a radio, you know how the wires are hooked up, and you know how they function with relation to one another, how they function with relation to the knobs and signals that are up here and all this stuff. So I think that function's crucial. But it seems like somebody who knew all the physical information, including, you know, what information was being propagated where, what was hooked up to what, she knew it's not in the blender, she knows that it's doing what it's doing, why would she be in the dark about what its function was? If the function is a physical feature, it's going to be underwritten by the physical pushings and pullings that are a matter of this system working. And I think that we actually have a lot of reason to be optimistic about getting a story of the mind in terms of certain things, like beliefs, desires, and stuff like that, in terms of those pushings and pullings, because we can largely explain what their function is, what they do. One of the things about the taste of, the particular taste of, you know, a particular sauce or a particular look of the red is that it's a little harder to actually triangulate the function. So specifically. So in other words, I guess I think that even given the function, and actually Jackson talks about this, even if you give her the functions, she won't necessarily know that it has to feel like this in order to play that particular functional role.
I've got several other questions. Keep your comments to a minimum and then ask your question.
Like yourself, I'm also a physicalist.
And physical.
However, I think the problem that you're thinking about, I think can be solved.
Good job!
Yes.
Turn it off.
It's on.
Hold it close to your mouth.
As a physicalist like yourself, I think the problem isn't the way you're defining physicalism. Most people, and it sounds like you're doing,
the problem is with the way
are defining physical as something solid. That there are forces, there are waves, there's all kinds, there's gravity, there are all kinds of things that are not solid, but they are physical. Everything is physical, including brain waves. Therefore, I don't see the problem. Subjectivity is a production of the brain. It produces consciousness.
We all agree.
Because if there's no thing out there to be conscious of, there is no consciousness. Consciousness is of necessity. Always consciousness of something, called physical. And so they go together. If there are things, there is a consciousness that knows it, is because there are things. Therefore, I'm arguing that it is consciousness itself is not just a function, as he says, it's more than that. It's just actually physical function.
Yeah, so most of what you said, actually, Jackson's going to agree with. Everybody agrees that everybody on both sides of this debate, even the non-physicalists, agree that consciousness is a production of the brain. I mean, so David Chalmers is probably, you know, I don't know, he's probably the prototypical non-physicalist at the moment. He believes that consciousness is a production of the brain, right? He just believes that, you know, a production of something doesn't mean that, to be produced by it means it's not identical to it. You get the brain, when the brain works in a certain way, it's going to produce consciousness, but the question is consciousness itself a physical feature? And just because it's produced by a physical thing does not thereby make it physical. The question about whether or not it's physical, according to him, has to do with whether or not it can be completely and exhaustively described by the sort of explanation we give in the physical sciences. So I think he'd agree with you, the dualist would, by saying, totally produced by physical stuff, but that doesn't make it physical because it can't be exhaustively described by the physical description. You're going to miss something. And that's why he would call it not physical. As a matter of fact,
what is it missing? What is it missing?
Well, so, I think can't do better than to kind of reflect on Mary's position in the room. What would she, if you're somebody who thinks, no, she's going to know everything, she's not going to be surprised by walking out, then I'm not really in a position to argue with you. But if you feel like she learned something, that's what she's missing.
The question back here is
You touched some point about the dichotomy, and if I get this right, one aspect of the bigger picture of your argument is that would you say that there are more than one approach to address the same question?
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I'm a biologist, I'm a scientist, but at the same time that I start to understand and actually try to understand the theological aspect of the same question we're asking, at the same time metaphysical or astrological aspect of the same question.
Well, I don't want to open the floodgates to astrology, hopefully.
Astronomy. You like astronomy?
Oh, astronomy. Yeah. I'll let astronomy in the door. I absolutely think that. I think that the physicalistic explanation, explanatory framework, is exceedingly powerful. I think it's probably the greatest development of humankind. But I do think that, yeah, it would be a mistake to think that that is the only way to view things. And I think that actually there is a subjective approach to things. And it's actually, my next work, if I ever get to the next work, the next work is to try to argue that basically, once you make the step to say that things like consciousness are beyond the purview of physicalistic explanation, that that's a pretty significant concession, because there's a whole lot of things in our own lives that we care a lot about that can't be described without consciousness. Right? And so, you know, while Jackson makes it sound like a fairly small little detail, a small thing that's sort of left out, I agree with you. I think that actually it opens up, the possibility that there are explanatory frameworks that are extraordinarily rich that we would be really suffering if we, ignored to only focus on the physical.
Great question over here.
I just wanted to ask, when you said that Mary is in the room and she has perfect information, it's really not a matter of the information transmission devices that was provided. I mean, like our touch is a transmission device.
Yeah.
It's transmitting signals.
Yeah.
And so she can't possibly have perfect information in that room.
That's right.
Am I right about that?
That's right.
We would have to be able to run a wire that someone would input all the properties of a particular rose.
Hold on. I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time.
We would have to input particular properties of a rose or a napkin or taste, and they would have to be put into her brain in order for her to have actual perfect information.
So Jackson's claim isn't that she has perfect information.
It's just that she has physical information.
She has the perfect physical
information. Okay, well, what about this then? Just let me ask you. What about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that we can't simply
count
the spin and the position of a particle simultaneously? So she's never going to be able to have that. I mean, until we overcome that.
Well, yeah, I'm going to admit something that's somewhat embarrassing. I think that actually the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is an epistemic feature.
So you're thinking the measuring device is causing us.
Yeah, I don't believe in genuine uncertainty, I guess. But I think it's probably.
Well, tell Feynman that,
If you find a way for me to tell Feynman that, we'll have really done something. But no, I mean, but regardless, I do think that, so let's give her perfect information, modulo the uncertainty, or, you know, the uncertainty principle allows for certain probability distributions and things like that. Let's give her all that. If it turns out that basically consciousness is hidden in the uncertainty with a location and speed of those sorts of things, I'll be shocked. Yeah, that'd be really, yeah.
I'm a programmer, so I deal with systems. And from a systems point of view, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that there are some aspects of consciousness that can be communicated from without a system, and there are some aspects of consciousness which are still physical but are formulated only within a system. So even though the smell of a rose or the color of a rose, it cannot be communicated from external to that system, it's still a physical occurrence, because the neurons form new associations within the brain that create an association with that color. It's still physical.
I think the story gets pretty complicated in trying to explain exactly what it means to have this sort of within a system representation, but I think that what I said is completely consistent with that picture. Yeah.
My name is Mona Magnus, and I am not a scientist.
Me neither.
By any means. However, I'm a realist. Okay?
Yeah.
And I love hearing all of these philosophies and all of these ideas and scientific things. But while Mary is in this room, she has had no contact with other human beings. I'm also a sociologist. She's had no contact.
That's a scientist of a sort. You sold yourself a little bit short there.
She has no contact with other human beings.
I'm imagining she does, actually. She has contact through, like, so, you know, she, like, the same way that I have contact with my text, or he has contact with his cell phone.
Okay, that does not... Look, I've raised 4 children. I know what I'm talking about. You learn,
yeah, she won't have done that.
You learn through the experience of relating to other people skills that are impossible to teach.
Yeah, so that's
one of them is called gut feeling. Mm-hmm. And some people are extremely sensitive to gut feelings, and they can see a thief. 2 seconds. Okay.
What?
See a thief.
A thief.
But she has feelings about other
people. Yeah, no, I know about the gut, but I see a thief. I don't know. I question that. But anyway,
so she, no, really.
Intuition.
Yeah. Intuition.
Intuition.
Yeah. And it comes from a lot of experience.
Yeah.
And so what I'm saying is the whole model just seems to lack any kind of relationship, this is my opinion, mm-hmm. to anything that we can think about, mind, body, brain, we are all one.
Well, that last step was a doozy. But but I do think...
We don't use it.
There's a question. There are a bunch of things there. Yeah. I think there's... I mean, one of the things you're saying is actually completely in concert with what I'm saying. In some ways, I might even be more optimistic about physical explanation than you are. I'm inclined to say the physical explanation is going to give us the thieves and everything else in a whole lot better way than the gut feelings are. And it's going to explain probably what the gut feelings amount to. But if what you're saying, though, basically, is that you have to have subjective experience in order to fully understand the world, then actually, you know, welcome to the club. You're on my side.
I'm on your side.
Then you just leave it. Another interesting thing you said is actually something that a very famous philosopher named David Lewis made a lot of. He actually made the argument that what was missing is not actually information at all. He made the argument that what was missing is actually abilities. That Mary has all the information, and Jackson's crazy to think she doesn't. But just like by knowing what it's like to touch your toe, or knowing all the physical descriptions of a gymnast, that doesn't mean I can be a gymnast, right? And he thinks that, you know, maybe with you, that basically it's a matter of abilities, not of information. And I think that that's an important, interesting point.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm interested in the relationship of the physicality that you're describing and creativity. Is that creativity simply an an extrapolation of the physical, taking it to the next order. And I'm trying to relate Mary being in the room and then walking outside the room and seeing the red rose and having that experience, which she had not previously had. Now her receptors and her neurons are clicking with the red rose, and it's another experience, just like the first time when she got in the room, she turned on the computer. That was a new experience. So now she's going to have an original thought, a creative thought. Is that an extrapolation of these neurons going to the next level, the next higher order of thought?
That's a good question.
Well, I don't know what you mean by extrapolation exactly. The interesting thing about calling this a creative thought is that it appears to be something that's quite passive. It appears to be something that, you know, she's, I mean, like, you know, you can have her never feel pain and then have somebody hit her over the head with a hammer. I don't call it creativity, you know. Yeah, I mean, like, it seems like it's a very passive sort of receptive thing.
That outside her experience, she is now delving into some thought process for which she has no experience. How did she get to that place through your theory?
Well, it's an extrapolation insofar as basically it is a matter of the physical workings, working in a way that they've never worked before, that provides her with this new information. Mm-hmm. So if that's what you mean by extrapolation, then I think that it is an extrapolation. But I think one of the interesting things about subjective experience is that it very rarely requires us to extrapolate in any intellectual sense. I think that we over-intellectualize things if we start to think that basically perception involves theoretical extrapolations or something like that. I'm not sure whether I'm addressing your question, but I think that in a sense, it certainly gives her new resources to use her creativity on. But part of what I'm saying actually is that given purely the physical information, she can be as creative as she wants. And she's not going to get the right sort of information.
She doesn't know how to be creative. Everything is worked.
She may know how to be creative. She's probably a damn good theorist, actually. I mean, like, it's just that, you know, even if she guesses at, like, what, you know, Red's going to be like, she's going to lack what sort of connection between, for example, the neuroscientific story and the redness that we get, for example, between the microphysical explanation of the boiling of water and the boiling of water. We see that's a sort of transparent framework, but you're not going to get that because of Red.
Actually, he stole my question, but to put a period to it, then are we saying there is no such thing as creation as we conceive it? It's all based on prior knowledge, or Da Vinci just drew those pictures of us flying because he saw bird flies, and surely we can do it, and that's... So
I don't think anything that I say has anything, I mean, to be honest, I don't think anything I've said has any entailments about the limits of creativity. I mean, it's, you know, as far as what I've said, I mean, that would be something that I'd have to actually look at the science and psychology to do, which as a philosopher I'm not allowed to do. I think it's consistent with what I say, that basically creativity is, you know, not even a causal problem. Like, it could be... Everything I say is consistent with a non-deterministic universe, for example, where our thoughts are not deterministically determined by our prior thoughts. That's all consistent with what I'm saying. I don't think I have a good amount of creativity, and I don't understand it.
Hi, my question is simply, I think I have to echo what this lady said. I think the way you approach the problem has to be with the information, because the information you're given, it's just oral and visual. Human beings, they get the information, it's not from just two sources.
Yeah.
They got all those senses. So in order for you to convey complete information, you gotta have all of that information available. If all that information is available, I think you could be that physicalist and be able to determine and understand the world the way you would otherwise. But if you're just getting piecemeal information in this case, either just audio or video, you don't get the whole feel. So you really cannot approach that problem without understanding the information defect being conveyed.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that a blind physicist is necessarily going to be a bad physicist?
Not necessarily, but you're talking about a very...
You're limiting an area of knowledge, information.
Do you think
that... if you want to be a complete person, then all the information has to be complete.
Yeah, so the question really isn't whether or not she has all the information, right? It's Jackson's point and mine as well, that she doesn't have all the information. Right, if that's part of the argument. The point that what she does have is all the physical information. Now, what does that mean? And I agree that that's something that I haven't really cashed out. But what Jackson's going to want to say, and I'm going to want to say something, well, actually, I'm going to want to disagree with him on this, and this is part of this, so I may be on your side here, I think. What Jackson's going to say is, look, physical information, what I mean by it is the sort of information that is developed by physical scientists. Right. And when they tell you about electrons, they don't say go touch one. They don't say go smell one. They say here's what an electron is. Right? And it has to do with basically the way it, you know, obeys laws, you know, in space over time. And you know, you don't need the senses. It's not like, you know, you're missing something about electrons by not actually having the ability to see one. Right? You got it. Right? So I think what Jackson's going to say is physical information in the sense that he's talking about is the sort of information that's like that, that's sort of conveyed, that you know, is about, I mean, I would say, the location of things in space over time. And that there are, and what he's going to say is, that's not all the information. And you're going to agree, but he's going to say, at that point we agree. You know, we agree that, you know, that's not going to cover it. But physics by itself, right, is not going to give you what you're talking about. Yeah. Well, then you're more of a dualist than I am, right? Because you think that actually there's even more left out of physics than I do, right? I think that it's only just a couple feelings, right? But like, I mean, if you think that basically you can tell a physical story of the world, and you have failed to completely tell the story of the world, then I don't know how you're a physicalist.
That isn't really the argument here. The argument is that if you're physics, the problem that you're solving is physics. Problems. Where as a human being, the problem you're dealing with are not physical all the time. It could be any different. So if you're gonna define your problem as a brain versus just physics theory, that's not what you're trying to say here. If I can be a physicalist without understanding anything about physics, just because someone tells me information, that does not actually make me who I am.
No, I think that's right, but if you believe that basically the full physical story of you does not make you who you are, then I think you're not a physicalist.
We have a question.
Let me come back to one of the more distinctive aspects of the presentation, the subjectivity part you mentioned. And it sounded to me that this subjectivity is going to be rather inherently, perhaps necessarily, private. And so I was wondering how you deal with the recognition that there are other minds, to use the traditional terminology, other conscious beings, such as yourself.
Yeah, I don't believe in those. No, actually, I think that the knowledge argument, in a surprising way, depends upon the recognition that there are other conscious minds, because actually one of the things that Jackson insists upon is that what Mary doesn't know is she doesn't know something about other minds, namely other people seeing roses. She doesn't know that basically, oh my God, it's been like that all the time when they've been seeing roses. Now, I do think that you've got a good point here, which is that if you view consciousness in this way, then yeah, it's going to look like it's, you know, some sort of ultimate inner sanctum such that, you know, each one of us has, you know, a little box and none of us can see inside it from the outside, right? And that's the traditional mind-body, problem of other minds. I mean, I think that what I might suggest is that once you actually know, for example, once Mary's in a position to know, okay, well, when I'm having this particular brain state, I'm having this sensation, she can actually look at your brain and see that you're having that sort of brain state and know that you're having that sensation. So, I mean, you can you can doubt that, but the idea would be you have the same cause, same effect. And you can sort of infer from the fact that the same cause is present in you, that's present in me, and that gives rise to red feelings in me, probably gives rise to red feelings in you, and that might be enough for knowledge. I agree. I think that there's a worry that she can't know it. But so far, that's actually consistent, really, with Jackson's picture, my picture, which is that, you know, in some ways you have to be a subject to understand what it is to be a subject. And it could very well be that it's an implication of this, that to some degree, we don't actually fully understand each other.
Question back here. All
right, thanks. So now, I'm thinking back on what the gentleman over here was saying, and so the more that I ponder it, the more it seems like Jackson's formulation is kind of a sleight of hand, where he's more exploring, and I want to ask you, do you believe that he's more exploring the boundaries of linguistic communication as opposed to actual knowledge? Because when you're defining actual knowledge, that experience of seeing the roads, of tasting food, versus that which could be conveyed using a very limited form of input. You're using sort of the wrong modality to convey what you consider this information to be.
Yeah, and so I think that, I mean, that is a way, I mean, to put it, I personally think that the limitations of language, I mean, I'm tempted to agree with you completely and say that basically this is all a picture of the limitations of language. I actually think it may be a little worse than that, because I think that it's not just that we lack, I mean, we do, I mean, like, we do have all the language to describe, I mean, I'm assuming we do have all the language to describe spins and, you know, momentums and energy and things like that. So, if we have a perfect ability to describe that, and that is all there is, then it looks like language isn't the problem in some ways. Like, I mean, it is true, of course, that, like, I mean, we want to say, well, I can't describe exactly what it's like for me to taste the brisket, but why not, if it's the case that, like, we're able to describe the momentum of particles across time, and that's all that there is? I mean, it looks like we have a very good language for describing physical stuff. And if the entire world is physical, where's the linguistic limitation?
Next question here.
You've almost answered my question three times now.
I'll bet I don't want to stop.
You down to it.
Yeah.
Suppose that Mary knows the 80 billion term Schrodinger equation for what her brain would, what state her brain would be in if she was looking at a rose.
Yep.
Until she looks at a rose, she doesn't know how to put her mind in that state. She may know what the state is. She can describe it perfectly, given Heisenberg. But she doesn't know how to do it. I think you said a while ago, you've learned a skill. And that skill is to put your brain in the state. I can do that. I can go into a green room and imagine a red rose because I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've learned how to do that. That's the knowledge that you acquire, right? How to put your brain into a certain state.
Well, I mean, so my reticence to accept this skill-based account is that it seems like I'm inclined to say that some skills generate new knowledge and some don't. So let's take, so I have the skill to put my pancreas in a lot of different states by virtue of eating stuff, right? Now, by virtue of being able to do that, right, so I leave the room, I'm suddenly able to put my pancreas in a certain state. Now, let's assume it's the sort of state that actually isn't associated with feeling at all, right? It's, you know, it's just, you know, funny pancreatic state. Do I thereby feel like I've gotten any sort of significant knowledge about the world? No.
Nothing to do with your nervous.
Well, right. But there's something interesting about the fact that this is an ability that looks like it not only gives her a different ability to enter a certain state, but the entering of that state seems to actually tell her something about the world. And so it's consistent with what I'm saying, well, what Jackson is saying, that there's an ability here. But what we might say is, boy, this looks like the sort of ability that doesn't only sort of just put you in a new state, it puts you in a new state that enlightens you in a certain way about the way the world was that you didn't know before. The pancreatic state doesn't do that. Now, maybe it has something to do with the nerves, but that's just to say that basically entering these nerve states gives you new information. So I think you're totally right, that basically it's all about being able to put yourself in the new state. The million-dollar question is it the case that merely being able to put yourself in the new state is what's going on here, or is it the fact that putting herself in that new state enables her to get information she hadn't had before? It seems to me like...
What difference does it make?
Well, one is consistent with physicalism, and one isn't. I mean, well, at least for Jackson. Because if there's new information, then it's not just the ability, right? The ability actually enables her to find something else about the world that was left out by what she knew before. If you basically... So of course it's the case that with new abilities come new information. Sometimes. Some abilities don't do that. But the question is basically, have you finished sort of explaining what's going on if you've just said that she's got a new ability? And the answer is no. You've got to give her a new ability, but what's actually important is that there was something enlightening about having that ability. It actually filled in a gap in her understanding about the world. And that gap doesn't look like... That gap looks informational. It looks like she knows that the world is a certain way she didn't know before.
Okay, we have time for about three more questions.
Perhaps I don't understand the conundrum, and I apologize if I'm not on the right
track.
You keep talking about learning things, but what about when people knew something and they had a brain injury and they no longer know that? I mean, I had a mother-in-law that was 75 years old, and she had smoked for many years, and she had a desire consciously to quit smoking, but she had never been able to quit smoking. Well, she got cancer a few years ago, and it was cancer of the breast, and she was going through chemotherapy, and evidently the chemotherapy affected the brain, and she woke up one morning and she didn't remember that she smoked. And she never smoked another cigarette. She didn't have a desire. She didn't even have a memory of smoking. She could still remember all of us. She could still communicate linguistically, but she never smoked another cigarette. And consciously, before that, she had not been able to quit. And it was just instantaneous. And, you know, people have brain injuries and they wake up. I mean, they have a brain injury that affects a certain part of the brain. They don't know how to, they don't have a certain emotions any longer. You know, they don't have feelings towards their family any longer. If you think the other way, in the reverse of losing, you know, a feeling or a knowledge that you have, you know, it seems to me it's a very physical.
I totally agree, and I'm sorry to hear about this, but it's definitely my view that it is all physical, and that basically, you know, you get physical damage, and that's gonna very well limit a whole.
Who you are.
Absolutely. I mean, I think who we are is 100% determined by our physical makeup. I completely agree with you, and I hope that that I don't mean by suggesting that in some sense consciousness is mysterious to be suggesting that it's not ultimately underpinned by physical processes like that.
Two more questions.
Just a real quick question: are you comfortable, or can you live with this, just where it is now, that basically? To experience these things, you have to have a conscious mind. As far as you know, only exists with the brain, and you can never really comprehend experience without being a conscious brain with the mind and experiencing that stuff. So basically, that's just about as far as you can go. There's always going to be something happening inside a conscious brain that can't be reduced. Because basically what you're saying, but I guess my question is, why is that necessarily a problem?
Why is it a problem that we... I don't think it is a problem in an important sense, because I think, I mean, as long as we can say it's physical. If we say it's not physical, I think we got a problem, because I think that explaining how something non-physical could interact with all this stuff is a real problem. But as long as it's physical, and we recognize that basically this is a limitation on a certain mode of explanation, I don't think it is a problem. Now, something that does trouble me a little bit is that, you know, if we recognize that, if we accept my view, which is that basically some forms of physical stuff can only be fully understood if you are that physical stuff, basically if you have a particular perspective, you know, that means that opens up the possibility that these heads here aren't the only nooks and crannies in the world that actually are like that. You know, like, why do I think that there's not a whole bunch that I don't know about the grasshopper, or about the electron, or about the rock, that because I'm not a rock, because I'm not an electron? I mean, that sounds kind of crazy, but once you admit that basically there's a limitation on objective explanation, it does strike me that we have to be even more modest than I think, you know, than we might think about our understanding of the world.
It occurs to me that the thought experiment that you perform with Mary is a bit contrived and difficult to imagine.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you're familiar with the Molyneux question.
Yeah.
And might you make the same type of observation, same type of argument based on that, where you have an example of something that the question was raised, similar to the Mary situation, and the answer was given in the early 20th century.
Well, actually, even more recently than that, actually, they recently given, the Molyneux question, correct me if I get wrong, but the Molyneux question has to do with basically if somebody is blind and perceives, you know, a couple of shapes, let's say a square and a triangle, with their hands. Right?
Better a sphere and a cube.
Sphere and cube with their hands, and then suddenly they're given sight. Will they be able by sight alone to tell which is the sphere and which is the cube? And this perplexed philosophers for a little while. I have to say, I've always found it an odd thing to be a philosophical question. It seems to me that this is very much a purview of science. And as a matter of fact, I think a couple of scientists have basically solved it. They actually had the surgery with, I believe it was some children from India, that they actually recently gave them sight soon after actually they had the opportunity to touch these spheres with cubes. And then they asked them, which one's which, right? And they actually were not able to do it. So anyway, that solves that. But I see your point, which is that basically that's another case where it's a philosopher trying to extrapolate some sort of philosophical conclusion from a case where somebody's limited information and when they can't conclude from that information. And as a matter of fact, do a little science and you solve it. The difference, I think, is that if you give them all the information about the cubes, not just information that's tactile, but all the information, nobody, including Molyneux, would doubt that they would be able to tell you that based on sight plus that information, that these were cubes, these were triangles, these were spheres. The addition of all the physical information is pretty important there. And I agree that it's difficult to put ourselves in Mary's position, and maybe that's a crucial failing of the thought experiment. But if it is a food crystal failing of the thought experiment, what does that show? Well, I think it may show that actually we are not in a position to really imagine a full understanding of the world. And, you know, that's important too.
Let's give a round of applause. Thank you so much.